Well, hello there, and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's Sunday evening here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. It's 10 o'clock. It's dark outside. It's freezing. It's minus 5 degrees, although I swear it's colder. But we're all warm and cozy here at Blockhead Central. And with me tonight, I have the lovely Catherine S., who is a writer for Countercurrents. And we are doing one of those month in review shows. Will be reviewing the best Countercurrents articles for the month of November, because November was the best month ever on Countercurrents, the best month yet at any rate. But Catherine, would you care to introduce yourself for those few people who may not know you in the chat?
Hi, Countercurrents Writer's Block listeners. I hope you can hear me just fine. I am coming in from Ohio, and it's also very cloudy. I think Nick, in one of his articles this month, used a steely November. Well, it's turning into a steely December here, but it's cold, and I'm very happy to be here on the Writer's Block again. I guess this is my third time now, something like that.
Yes, this is the third time the Writer's Block has hosted. Well, it could be the fourth time. Yeah, okay. The fourth time if you count the birthday show.
But that's right.
This is the third, all caps, all 2 hours Writer's Block we've had. Can you people get me? Am I coming in right? I'm trying something new with the headphones here.
But it is November in review. It is the best month ever on Countercurrents. And here we have, for the third time, Catherine S. And of course, I would love to, say a few words about, Alyaska Chaga people. Alyaska Chaga tea is what keeps me going. It's what keeps my voice in this pristine state. Yes, my dulcet sounds are completely to blame on Alaska Chaga. Well, at least they are maintaining what God saw fit to ordain. But I would love to chill them with the traditional sip of hot tea. But due to logistics problems, the tea will not be coming as soon as I thought. It is a shame. It is a shame. I should enforce stricter discipline here at Casa Gilvi, but I'm a soft-hearted person. I'm a real. I'm going to be, one of those permissive dads, I suppose. But let's just jump into the meat of the matter before I embarrass myself further. Catherine, you wrote something. I'm just going to come out and say it. Something phenomenal this month. You wrote about a certain historical occurrences in the Italian peninsula, specifically the Battle of Cannae and the fate of ruin, which lies at the heart of every city. It is tragic to contemplate, but, why don't you tell us a little bit about that? Why don't you tell us about the Eternal City, the Ruined City, and the Battle of Cannae?
Okay, well, my training was in history, but I did most of it in the early modern 18th century. But I'd always had a real fascination with antiquity. So I'd heard of the Battle of Cannae, of course, but I'd never really read about it. And it was a couple months ago, I was reading something by Victor Davis Hanson, who's also mentioned one of the articles we'll be talking about this month. And it was a short piece, and it left me wanting a whole lot more, because you do kind of have to know a lot about history to recognize something extraordinary. And this was an extraordinary battle, both in terms of the number of casualties, the way that the general who won the battle did it, Hannibal, and then the aftermath of the battle. Because you read these chroniclers, these ancient Roman chroniclers, and while they might be biased, I believe them when they say that had this happened to any other nation other than Rome, they would have been defeated and negotiated with Hannibal. But the Romans were never going to negotiate when they were not in a position of strength to do so. And so Hannibal ended up having to leave the Italian peninsula after winning maybe the most complete victory of all time. And it ended up being for nothing. And I think that was maybe one of the most dramatic kind of battles, episodes over this period of antiquity that I really ever read about. And it really just sort of captured my imagination, so I wanted to share that. And some of it is, quite frankly, drama. But it's drama that you can draw from in terms of these generations of men who are engaged in these Punic wars. And these are the fathers and then the sons and the grandsons avenging their past defeats. And Carthage, of course, ends up being wiped off the map, basically. And Rome, after this disastrous battle in which they've lost 20% of their fighting male population, in less than 100 years, they're rulers of the world, basically, this Mediterranean world. And that's really interesting to me. And that's why I read it.
But that's very interesting. Okay. I mean, I understood what you were saying. It's not that you weren't understood. It's just that the audio is bad. Have you tried it? Let's hear it without the headphones.
I'm without the headphones now. How do I sound?
Okay. That's great. That's good. We are in business. That sounds actually quite well, and it looks like StreamYard's echo cancellation is actually functioning for a change. We might be in luck. We might be in luck. Unlike Hannibal, who I'm always haunted by that sentence. I think it was one of his brothers who said it. Was it Hasdrubal or the one who had the boring name?
It was Hannibal, Marhabal,
right? Mm-hmm. Hannibal, you know how to win a victory, but not to lose one. And although, you know, in Rome, Total War, the strategy video game, it is attributed to Hasdrubal rather than Marhabal. And that always stuck with me. How to win a victory, but not how to use one. And longtime listeners, longtime leaders will know that I am, you could say, possessed by this idea of being distracted by a game, of being given a stick to chase, catching it, and realizing that, well, while you were chasing the stick, or the proverbial dog who caught the car. If you are the dog who caught the car, yes, you caught the car. You won the game of car chasing. But what did we really gain by catching the car, being dogs, of course? It's, and I see here, I mean, the core problem of the Second Punic War on the Carthaginian side was with Hannibal. Of course, he was out of supply. He was betrayed by many of his fellow Carthaginians. That notorious Punica Fide, the faith of the Phoenicians, which the Romans commented on. Well, they had it among each other as well. He was outnumbered. He was surrounded. He failed to break the resolve of Rome. He failed to, he failed to alienate Rome's Italian allies. At the time, of course, it was still the city-state system, and the Roman Empire wasn't really that. It was an alliance of city-states headed by Rome. But ultimately, managing to inflict a defeat of the scope and size of Cannae on the Romans was amazing, and yet it could not be converted into tangible military gains.
And this wasn't the only victory he won.
Yeah.
Right. He won multiple battles before this, which probably would have been ruinous to other city states. Then the thunderclap of Cannae, but that was followed up with other victories. And a lot of southern Italian allies did defect, not because of any attachment to Hannibal, but because they saw the wind was blowing this way, they thought. And he just kept winning, and then he had to leave because of attrition, logistics. The Romans completely, they just outlasted him. He was on this peninsula with a bunch of mercenaries. And you can't keep that up for what he did it for maybe 15 years, something like that. He eventually had to leave. He ran out of everything, basically.
Catherine, we are getting a little bit back of the, and people are suggesting maybe you close some of the programs on your device. People are speculating that maybe it's the CPU struggling to do the thing, so you would have better audio. But, you know, it's not the first time that the Romans managed to turn back such a brilliant conqueror. In much the same way, they inflicted ruin, you know, they suffered defeat after defeat from King Pyrrhus, right? Pyrrhus of Epirus, who, from where we get the term Pyrrhic victory. Basically, the victories won by Pyrrhus over the Romans were so hard won that he eventually had to end his campaign and return to Epirus. So it would not be the first time Rome won by having, well, let's call them better fundamentals. You see this sometimes in combat sports, and you know, in boxing. Sometimes the technically superior guy is simply defeated by the resilience of the other boxer, who can just take more punches, keep going, and has better conditioning. And these are very important, you know, the athletic aspects of the sport. But personally, I'm just amazed at the patience and the discipline of Fabian, of the Roman consul at the time, Fabian the Delayer. I'm going to mangle the Latin, but what was interesting was at the time where the younger men of the Roman Republic really wanted to charge into battle and prove themselves and their courage against Hannibal, it took the older, already proven man to understand that this was not an enemy who could be defeated in open combat, but could be defeated by, well, delaying. And hence they called him first derisively and then as an honorific, Fabian the Delayer. As people, we are being dissidents, being white nationalists who are facing an immensely powerful enemy, I think we have much to learn from Fabian the Delayer. Wouldn't you agree, Catherine?
Yes, I do. And how is my sound now?
The sound is actually excellent. Yeah.
Okay, good. I closed on my devices before I did this, but the only other thing I can do maybe is to restart the computer. That's really the only other thing I can do if it still sounds tank or scrambled. So yeah, let me know when I can do that. Yeah. Okay.
As soon as you start speaking, it gets scrambled.
Okay. Okay. Then I'm going to exit out of this, if you're okay with it, and start over the computer, and then maybe have a clearer image. Okay. I'll be right back.
Right. And while Catherine is Catherine is gone, I'm going to take the time to read a super chat. I'm going to take a time to read a donation on Entropy. And I don't know if the question is for me, but it did arrive, I see, on the 5th of, on the 12th, 5th of December. That's today. And it's a donation from Hortator21 and for 100 euros. Thank you. That is very generous. And we depend on your support to keep on trucking. But he asked, does Countercurrents have any writers with an interest in Christian theology? If so, I would be interested in hearing a CC, a Countercurrents dissident right opinion on matters pertaining to the Book of Revelation and any connection, however vague it might seem, to our current paradigm, especially in relation to vaccine mandates. Now, that is a very good question, Hortator. I'm afraid, however, that I'm not equipped to answer it. Which is why I suspect this was a question for our illustrious editor, Mr. Greg Johnson. Well, Dr. Greg Johnson, actually. But it is it is a generous donation. I will say personally, as a lay Christian, like I'm not a theologian, and that's the interesting thing. People hear I'm Orthodox and they expect me to understand Orthodox theology, and I was like, well, no, I was baptized into the Macedonian Orthodox Church when I was a year old, and they didn't impart any theology onto me, so I don't actually understand any theology, to be honest. I will, however, say that somewhere in the Bible, I don't remember where, there is "live not by lies," and the kuf is a lie, and they're trying to cajole us into taking the vaccine with lies. I mean, they're also using force. They're also trying to force our hands, but the main weapon of the enemy are lies, and I'm just not going to live by lies. I refuse to live by lies. I refuse to be manipulated into doing this thing that they want me to do. I will not inject this substance they are lying about into my body, and that is final. As to whether we have theologically inclined writers, I will ask around the water cooler. I will ask around the office. That's interesting. Catherine, welcome back.
How am I now? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you okay. That's much better. Maybe your device needed restarting. Sometimes these things happen. I mean, computers are strange. And Catherine, did you have a chance to listen to the entropy question, or would you like me to read it again?
I heard the tail end of your answer, so I can guess it, but I would like to hear the question, yes.
Right. The question is from Hortator 21 for 100 euros. Does Countercurrents have any writers with an interest in Christian theology? If so, I would be interested in hearing Countercurrents' dissident right opinion on matters pertaining to the Book of Revelation and any connection, however vague it might seem to our current paradigm, especially in relation to vaccine mandates. And if you're familiar with the theological aspects of the Book of Revelation, personally, I mean, I must say I'm remiss in my Christianity. I have not read the Book of Revelations, if I'm being honest. I preferred reading the Old Testament. It was a lot more fun.
Yes, the Old Testament is more fun for me too. I'm Catholic, and that is important to me. In general, most Catholics don't spend a whole lot of time on the Book of Revelations, at least I found. That's not really where they take their point of interest. I think that's become much more of a Protestant issue. Not that a lot of Catholic writers in the medieval period didn't talk about the four horsemen of the apocalypse and famous scenes like that. But my knowledge of the Book of Revelations is that, and I've heard different theories, but speaking of Rome, there's a theory that this apostle, I believe it was it Paul who wrote the Book of Revelations?
No, it was John.
So, John? He had
John
this,
the Revelator.
John the Revelator. He was talking about, he was addressing it, aiming it towards Nero, I think. Mm. So it had a political valence to it as well. I don't know that a lot of people know exactly what to make of the Book of Revelations. And I think it has a lot of very mythological, stirring elements to it that you could see in a lot of different themes that come up again and again throughout history and in stories. We're going to be talking about the Grail King, I think. And so there's all of these different images that are very evocative. But I'm not probably the person to ask when it comes to talking about the Book of Revelations, beyond which I did my Phantom Horseman thing. And obviously there's that image, but it's really talking about this idea of the horsemen as being powerful and having a impunity, because you can ride everywhere. You're above the people, right? And you're bringing this sort of pestilence. And I guess you can connect that maybe to this plague that's going around and the quote cure that they're prescribing for it.
It is interesting. Yeah, I was just commenting on it that, okay, I'm stereotypical European. How arrogant Americans are to speak of the car or the truck as a symbol of independence without noticing that these vehicles are very dependent on roads and gas infrastructure, you know, gas stations. Genuinely mean, when you grow up in this walled garden, which is the modern transportation system, you really don't think outside of it. But if you want to be truly independent, you know, if you want to be, get a beast of burden, get a horse, ride a horse, that grants a liberty which the car simply cannot provide. Now, of course, the horse is slower and they're more difficult to maintain, right? You got to know how to take care of horses. I certainly don't. I've never really even been on a horse. I've gotten on top of a donkey once and it was a pleasant experience, but well, not for the donkey because I'm a big guy, but it is one of those, I guess. But we should be discussing Hannibal and Cannae. Now, I think we left off with Fabian the Delayer. You were talking about Fabian, I think.
Yeah, you were saying that how you admired his patience, right. I think. There's this, in ancient history, but also moving forward, this idea of, well, we just need to go out there and fight the, quote, decisive battle. You know, we need to meet our enemy in the field, and we're going to have at it, and after that, it will be decided. And this is supposed to be the honorable way that you're supposed to win a war. And that's nice. But a lot of times, and you saw this with Cannae, you had this decisive battle, complete victory, and it really decided nothing. And so now you have to come up with a different way to win this war, to defeat your enemy, because it's not going to come with just this fair meeting on the battlefield, facing your enemy and destroying him, because, you know, that doesn't work. And I think also there was this fetish, I think, in antiquity, but also especially in the 18th century with the Enlightenment, the fetish of the genius, you know, the genius commander who's going to win because of his brilliance. And, you know, we saw this with Napoleon too, who was a brilliant commander, but ended up losing the war. And you have a lot of these commanders like that. And the reason they lost is because their strategy didn't work. Their tactics on the battlefield were great, but the overall strategy of winning the war, it broke down. And so I think that's what the Romans ended up learning during the Punic Wars. And of course, they found their own genius too, Scipio Africanus, who was able to finally meet Hannibal in the field face to face and win.
That is the way to look at it. I mean, this is a big debate in history, right? What's your theory of history? Is it driven by events? Is it driven by material facts? Or is it driven by great men? And I don't think we can doubt that great men contribute to the movements of history, but I'll just return to my boxing metaphor. If you don't have good fundamentals, and Carthage simply did not have fundamentals as good as Rome, it lacked the asabiya. It's, you know, for those of us who like cheesy 80s action films, it's like Rocky versus Drago, right? Ivan Drago, he's very, very strong, but no matter how hard you punch Rocky, he just does not fall to the ground. Or if he does, he just climbs back up, and he is not human. He's like a piece of iron, I believe Dolph Lundgren said at that point. Another interesting thing you had to say, well, Scipio Africanus had to say, and you were quoting him, is that in seeing the ruin of Carthage, or was it his son, the one after the third war, the third Punic War?
It was his grandson, right? By adoption. He was actually a cousin, but Aemilianus, Scipio Aemilianus. Yeah. Right. 146 BC.
So what happened was, as he was beholding the destruction of the city of Carthage, because of course Carthago delenda est, said, as Cato the Elder would say, Carthage must be destroyed. Oh, and Carthage must be destroyed. Finally, the Romans did march over to Africa, which is today Tunisia, and laid waste to Carthage. And, you know, I've seen the ruins. They're Roman, by the way. They're the ruins of Roman Carthage. Nothing really remains of Punic Carthage, of Phoenician Carthage. But in seeing the destruction of the enemy city, Scipio Aemilianus saw the destruction of Rome itself. Now, if you would comment on that, Catherine, if you would comment on what you had to say there.
Yeah, so when he looked out on Carthage burning, it was, you know, desolate. And when you look out on a city like that, it becomes not the city that it was maybe hours before. It becomes an image of the ruined city, which paradoxically is also kind of this eternal image that's going to come back again and again to your city next, probably. And so when he looked on Carthage burning, he saw not one city, but he saw three cities, I argued. He saw Troy, okay, the quintessential ruined city of antiquity, and it was needed to burn, to be destroyed, so that Rome could be founded by his descent, by Troy's descendants, and Carthage, that now had to be destroyed so that Rome could rule the Mediterranean, so that Rome could win this war. And of course, he's also seeing Rome, because he says, I see in those burning ruins my own country, my own people, because at one point, Rome is going to go the way of all empires, of all republics, of all nations, and it will fall.
That is very profound and also very far-seeing, because, I mean, If we are students of history, right, from the purely material historic point of view, the destruction of Carthage is the high point of the Roman Empire. The Carthage is the final boss of the Mediterranean, so to speak. Yeah, there were still great powers in the Mediterranean, but they were all old, decrepit, just, you know, powerless to stop Rome in any way, shape, or form, just stumbling blocks on the way to, well, what became the empire. The real final boss of the Mediterranean was Carthage, the only city which could stand up to Rome. And it fell. But Scipio Aemilianus was, you could say, wise enough, maybe melodramatic enough, to not only see in it the destruction wrought on Troy, as which had at one point been an equal rival to, as of yet, ununited Greece, but also the future destruction of Rome. It shows a maturity, because when you look at our ruling class today, they would never say anything like that. In fact, they believe in the myth of infinite progress forever. Maybe it is due to the differences in our civilizations. Maybe the classic man being, of course, reverent of the prime symbol of the circle, of the perfect body, understood that history is cyclical, whereas we living in a Christian, or more accurately, post-Christian civilization, unfortunately, see history as a progression from creation to revelation. Someone mentioned the book of Revelation, and just cannot conceive of a time when even our own cities and countries and kingdoms will lay in ruin. I don't know. For me, it's easier because I live on a city which was a ruin in 1963. And it will be a ruin at some point in the future. The fact that, you know, Skopje is in an earthquake heavy area built on silt and very wet clay means that this city has been destroyed more times than can be remembered by written history, and it will be destroyed in the future. And there could be an earthquake while I'm streaming the writer's block, and just in case it happens today, you know, let me just cross myself here. So I guess this fact of destruction is closer to me than to, you know, maybe other people. But yeah. Just imagine the breadth of vision it would take. We are ruled by such narrow-minded, small people, you know, especially when we compare them to these ancient greats.
Yeah, they're just arrogant. And I would say that Rome, right, it's also built on a lot of ruins. And it's got all of these very old monuments there. I've been there once. And I stayed there maybe 4 days. And I saw the highlights. It's a very nice city. I liked it a little better than Paris, but that might be just the time when I went. The people who drive there are crazy. That's neither here nor there. Almost got run over 5 times. But there were a lot of gypsies. I do remember that. And the Colosseum was something. But the catacombs, wandering the catacombs, was really neat. And kind of disturbing. Of course, there's no bones left there. It's just this tunnel that you walk through, or at least the tunnels that we went through didn't have anything there. But they were lighted by these kind of flares. And I just kept thinking, these things are going to go off any second now, any second now. We're going to be stuck in this catacomb, just winding forever. But it's that sort of thing that you don't find here in the United States. The ruin that we see here in the United States is more like the ruin of Detroit, where it's just blight and it's happened very quickly. And it's completely different. There's nothing dignified about it.
Mm. Well, part of it could be the material. See, what survives from antiquity is marble and stone. Detroit was built in the 1930s. The real buildup of Detroit was in the 20s and 30s. And it's a German town, basically. I've never been, but so I've heard. It looks German, feels German when you walk the streets, so have people told me. And it's made out of concrete, and concrete does not age well. It's notorious among not only architects and builders, but also among people like us who call ourselves, I don't know what we are. We are documenters of decay for the time being in the West. And buildings, put up in the 1980s here in Skopje, they just, look ugly 40 years on because they're made out of concrete, because concrete just does not age well. I don't know. It's something about the material. It does not hold heat well. It does not hold facades well. Needs constant painting, constant cleaning. Marble, I don't think, has those problems. Stone even does not have those problems. Maybe it's one of those things, but maybe it's because it doesn't really have to be like that, because unlike, say, Rome in the 5th century, America has the material wealth necessary to rebuild Detroit, to keep it functioning, to keep it, a beautiful city. It just does not have the wherewithal, I guess, to do so.
Yeah. I think there's would we think that something like the Parthenon, say, if we could restore it now and see it in its original true form in, say, 3rd or 4th century BC, would we like it better than we like the ruins today? I don't know, because there's this disposition in a lot of European artists and writers, especially in the 18th and 19th centuries, to really fetishize the ruin as something sublime, as this in-between man-made object and nature. Sort of nature has had its way with this object that was once glorious and has turned it into something that is also glorious, but meditative, I suppose. And I think, yeah, I mean, there's no question that concrete and the things that we use to build today are not going to look nearly as picturesque as the Colosseum does right now. It's probably just going to be worn completely away. But there's also a industry called ruin porn even in the United States, that goes around and photographs these blighted cities, and people love it. They love these decayed warehouses, you know, for whatever reason. I think that's sort of something that we tend to like here in the West, for whatever reason.
We are an old civilization, very old, and I mean, we're younger than the Chinese, but we're no spring chickens. And I mean, I've done this too. Before there was the writer's block, there was Nickstream, which was in many cases just me getting drunk and exploring post-industrial wastelands. One time we went to an abandoned pool, and it's one of the saddest things I've ever seen in my life. I always tried, you know, entering abandoned factories around here. We have some great post-industrial blight here in Macedonia. So, you know, it's one of those things. But speaking of urban blight and people, you have here, the literary people on Countercurrents, Catherine S. And then there's me, of course. I mean, I'm not Catherine, but, you know, I know a thing or two about literature and about symbolism and about meaning. So you can ask me questions as well. And there's the entropy link if our heroic mods would just drop that into the chat for people's convenience. And it's also streaking right under my face on the screen. That's entropystream.live/countercurrents. We're not streaming live. However, you can still donate money and ask us questions. Or you just can just give out of the goodness of your heart. I hear it is the season of giving. It looks like a good time, Kat, to segue into. We were talking about meditation and ruins. Our boy Richard Hauck, he wrote something about Pizza Hut and how a bunch of Pizza Hut restaurants are going to be abandoned. And it's not the drive-thrus, but it's the family restaurants which are getting shut down. So the places where you can go and have a sit-down meal, whether with a family or maybe a girlfriend, maybe a boyfriend, and just have a good evening for, you know, affordable cost. And, you know, I've never been to a Pizza Hut because I've never been to America, but I've noticed the trend in food and dining, even here in Europe, is towards the atomized individual, towards eating, as we say here, eating on your feet, which is considered, well, something that not even poor but sad people do. Like, just look at this sad man eating alone, standing up, too busy to appreciate a meal, and especially here in the Mediterranean basin. Have you noticed that Pizza Huts are going away and family-oriented dining places are going away?
I've noticed about the Pizza Huts. I think Rich is right about that. I do remember going, like he does, to Pizza Huts on road trips, mostly. It would be when we would drive from Houston to Dallas to see family, and we'd stop halfway, and there was this Pizza Hut there. And it's exactly how he described, basically. It's those drapes. It's those Tiffany lamps, the red tumbler cups. And they bring out your pizza on an iron skillet that's hot. And is it the best pizza in the world? No, probably not. But it's okay. It's good. And for the ladies, I guess, the moms, they have a salad bar, whatever, you know. So you can go and do that. And you can play games. You do what a family does. And yeah, I had not really thought about Pizza Hut in a really long time. So I have to thank Rich for bringing that memory back. But it is one where he says, yes, he says something like, it's almost like being a ghost walking around in this kind of time period that has passed you by, or that maybe you've outlived your own time in a very strange way. But I do think he's touched on something about the family restaurant. Chuck E. Cheese's, you probably don't have that in Europe, do you? Okay. Oh. Well, it's basically, I know, Pizza Hut. Yeah. It's Pizza Hut, but it's kind of a kid's place where they go to have birthday parties and things like that, and the games and arcades. Those have kind of been ruined, mostly by I'm just going to say it, black people who who bring their problems there, right? And it's become just drama factories for baby mamas to fight over, yeah, their boyfriends while they have their kids there.
I don't usually interrupt people to read chat notes, but Gaius Maximus just called it chimpy cheese, and that's too funny.
Yeah, I mean, he's exactly right. Gaius is right. So, yeah, there's been a decline in that. And I think it's also not just Pizza Hut and places like Chuck E. Cheese, but even places like Chili's, people don't eat there anymore because they'd rather order in to their house and watch something on TV than go out and, you know, have a conversation, I guess, with other people in the world. And COVID has probably accelerated that. It's let's just order it on an app and have it delivered. We don't want to walk over to the pizza place ourselves and sit down. And that's just kind of how the world has turned out here. But yeah, RIP Pizza Hut. It was a good place. Had a lot of fun.
Yeah. Just to clarify, it's not closing down everywhere. It's just there's a die off of the sit down restaurants, and especially ones that cater to families. And it might seem like a small thing, but these things, they actually hew to demand a lot more. So they tell you something about the composition of the American people. And Steve Saylor spoke about this some time ago, I guess. The biggest differences in voting patterns, if you take out, you know, the obvious outliers, like, racially speaking, 99% of blacks vote Democrat. The biggest difference is not education level. It's not this. It's not that. It's marital status. Married people vote Republican like 60% of the time, or some ridiculously high number like that. Whereas unmarried people, they vote mostly Democrat, right? And that's the thing, right? The kind of people who remain unmarried, and a lot more people are unmarried these days, they are not the kind of people we like. They're not the kind of people who want healthful things like a wholesome family restaurant. And that's something else. I'm going to, walk over to places and purchase food. My brother really likes ordering in, but I generally only do it when I'm too beat to actually move myself to the place where food. Although a lot of eateries where I'm around are they're really working on this delivery only model, and they look at me like I have two heads when I want to, be a walk-in customer. But I'm a walker, right? I'm a person who walks around a lot. It's how I clear my head. It's how I keep myself sane. And sometimes, I want to eat when I walk, but, I sit on park benches. And now that I'm also banned from sitting in restaurants, I mostly eat on park benches when I'm eating out. That's something to think about. But it tells us something, that these restaurants catering to families are closing down. It could be that the American family is dying. And even if it's not dying, it's turning inward. It's people not leaving their houses because it's just not safe and it's not nice. We mentioned, chimpy cheese. This is a problem I've noticed not only in America, but also in Western Europe. Public spaces are just no longer pleasant because you got a bunch of, non-whites running around, being loud, being obnoxious, being dangerous. Let's not forget dangerous. I mean, you mentioned Paris. I was in Paris in 2012, almost got assaulted on the subway by a black person, obviously a black male in his 20s. I mean, who else? And it didn't ruin my stay in Paris, but I'm not going to say it was pleasant staring down a buck jogger on the Paris metro.
Yeah, I'm thankful that when I visited Europe, it was, before the really bad stuff started to happen. So this would have been, I think, 2003 I visited Europe. So the worst experience I had was a gypsy woman yelling at me in Rome, and whatever, you just kind of walk away from those people. So,
yeah. A lot of people ask me, you know, about gypsies, and they're not like blacks. They don't even come near the violence, but they more than make up for it in smell and lack of hygiene and obnoxiousness.
I didn't really understand what she was wanting from me. I don't know. I gave her a few euros, but I guess that wasn't enough. And
Give them money, they never go
away. I know. It was bad news, but I was a teenager and, you know, just trying to just get her away from me. But yeah. I think you were mentioning on, it was a previous podcast, how European cities in general, you don't like driving. And because European cities are nice to walk in, at least many of them still are. And I think you're probably right about that. You walk to clear your mind. And I often drive to clear my mind because, yeah, I guess it's probably safer, even given the traffic accidents in this country too, which, yeah, there are quite a lot of them.
Right. Although I will say that that Fahrvergnügen is a German word, right? And it means the joy of driving. And Germans do drive for pleasure and to clear their heads. But don't, you know, they also have the Autobahn over there. And if I could, you know, just go drive and no speed limit, it's what I would do to clear my head. I have tried driving to clear my head. I do it on the ring road here in Skopje, but it's an expensive way to clear your head. I'll do that because, you know, and then I have to, you know, there's a risk I'll be caught by cops because, you know, I'm not a speed limit respecting fellow. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But I think we can, we are talking about how we clear our heads. And we need a clear head for the next bit. We need a clear head to contemplate the loss of American deterrence. Now, this is Senile Joe and the Loss of American Deterrence, written by Morris van de Kamp. From what I understand, Morris has some experience in the American military. And he's saying that, well, we were discussing the various tactics and strategies of Hannibal and Scipio and Fabius the Delayer when we were discussing, you know, your article on the Battle of Cannae and the destruction of Carthage. Well, here's a chance to, you know, play armchair generals here. And think about the effect of deterrence, you know, the nature of deterrence, the idea that, you know, yeah, you can throw fighting words at me, but it will probably not be in your best interest to do so. And the fact of the matter is, America is just no longer feared like it used to be in the world. Now, you could say that this is due to having a, you know, drooling idiot at the head, when that's certainly a contributing factor. And before that, you know, we like Trump. Well, it's not like he's a serious person, right? He's this reality show worldwide wrestling character. And even before that, I mean, seriously, Barack Obama, that stuffed suit. So it's, I'm not willing to blame just Sleepy Joe for the loss of American deterrence. I think this is a systemic problem. It's one of those, it's not the brilliant general, it's not even that the general is incompetent. No, it could be a systemic problem there.
Yes, I think you agree. I think I agree with you. I've noticed that the past several presidential elections, they all come under heavy criticism for being illegitimate. And this has happened throughout American history. You have questions about an election, but it seems to be so virulent, you know, in every single one of these things. And I think it does point to something maybe more systemic. This kind of American power, not just declining, but just kind of splintering apart into these pieces right before our eyes. And I do think that Morris is pointing to something here. He would know about this better than I would. And you probably would too, because he uses the case study of Eastern Europe and what's going on between Russia and Belarus and Poland, right? And how before American deterrence would have been enough to curb Russian interference in this region. But it's not right now. And in fact, Germany has decided to make its own peace with Russia and has built this pipeline, which, you know, this is economic, political factor here that's going to bind these two together and undermine the European Union, which could be a good thing in some respects. But it does point to the fact that America is no longer feared, to the extent that I think he uses Victor Davis Hanson's definition when he's talking about deterrence is frightening people away from doing something without going into war with that person, open war with that person. So you avoid that. And we no longer have that sort of fear factor going on. But I guess I kind of want to know your reading of the situation in terms of this Belarus, Ukrainian, Polish, Russian thing going on, because that's something that I'm not too knowledgeable about.
Well, that's what's interesting to me is that you're the first person to ask me that since the crisis happened, and a lot of people had the chance. I guess I should have, again, well, we had the article on countercurrents all the way back in October before the crisis began in earnest, when we had the guy reporting that basically Lukashenko is importing these students, quote unquote, on student visas, you know, by the truckload, by the plane load, more specifically. And it was unclear what for. People are saying he's going to use them to hold the European Union, Poland, all of these places hostage to extract diplomatic concessions. But what was mentioned was that these Nigerians had forked over apparently their life savings to Lukashenko for these visas. So, my opinion is it's one of these things. People always look for grand stratagems being employed and empires clashing, but they tend to forget that the biggest clashes of empires have really been I'm going to use a very crude term. I'm sorry. I know there's a lady present, but there's no other term to be used. They're dick measuring contests between their tiny vassal states, and really just short-sightedness on the part of people like Lukashenko. What I think happened here was nothing more that Lukashenko wants money, right? He needs whatever, because he's also facing sanctions, just like Putin. So he's selling Belarusian student visas to Nigerians and Afghanis and Syrians. And he's promising these people that he's going to, you know, get them to the European Union. And if he can extract political concessions or geopolitical concessions from the European Union at the same time, so be it. But I think the primary motive, because, you know, Belarus is not in Russia's position. Russia can tank sanctions from the West for a very long time. Russia has a lot of natural resources. Belarus does not. And I think that the reason Putin protects Lukashenko is because he cannot afford to lose face. And that's another thing to think about in great power, imperial power politics. The most important resources are respect, face, and, well, deterrence, being feared, being respected, and being honored by your allies. I guess if your tiny tin pot vassal dictatorships get pushed around by the other big empires, you lose face. Hence, Putin has to protect Lukashenko, even though, you know, it's Lukashenko dragging him into this mess and not the other way around. And America losing deterrence emboldens men like Lukashenko to basically shit them, test them. Just what I'm going to do is I'm going to dump all of these undesirables, which you cannot acknowledge are undesirables, on the borders of your vassal states. Let's see you do something about it. And we're going to make a bunch of money at the same time. So that's my take on it. I think it's just classic Eastern European oligarchical greed and corruption, but now with geopolitical implications because it pits the Russian sphere of influence against the American sphere of influence. Now, I could be wrong, right? I have been wrong in the past, but I don't really believe in grand plans being left to men like Lukashenko. He just does not look like a serious person to me, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, the massing of migrants at the border seems to be a pretty disgusting and dishonorable, if perhaps effective, tactic here for Belarus. But yeah, I think Morris is really going with the argument that it's because America has, I guess, to use your words, lost face with the world through a combination of, well, Joe Biden, but also Jewish shenanigans. I think he mentions the impeachment as playing some kind of role. And he also kind of mentions Ukraine as kind of being this corrupt government here. And I'm not sure I really understood where he was going with that, because he does kind of, because he wants to talk about Russia, Russian power. And you're kind of saying that this is not really about Russia. This is mostly about these smaller, more local rivalries going on here. And so
it's almost always about local rivalries and the big powers, right? If you think back to the First World War, it was about a local rivalry between Austria and Serbia. It's or you think about the conflict which dragged Rome into war with the Seleucid Empire. It was the Kingdom of Rhodes or the city of Rhodes against some of the Seleucid vassal states. I forget which one. I mean, it was so insignificant, but it just these two empires were set on a collision course, or was Ptolemaic Egypt? I forget. Like it's one of these things that happen historically. You ally yourself with a small state, you embolden it to really start bullying its neighbors, and then its neighbors bully with larger states, you know, with big empires, and drag the two empires into wars. This is so this is what historically happens, and I suspect this is what happened behind the scenes, you know, in the halls of power in Minsk and in Moscow. I suspect Putin might be secretly cursing Lukashenko right now for making him lose face in this way. But again, Putin cannot afford to lose face. Neither can America, but America's been doing nothing but that lately.
I think that was also kind of part of the Roman situation too. It was all of these petty small states in Greece. We're saying, oh, the Macedonian king, he's doing this, that, and the other. And then they would call the Romans in, and the Romans would be like, oh, we don't really want to be an empire right now. We don't want to go help these people. But also, we have to. And then that's really what started the rivalry with Carthage, is because they started getting involved with places like Sicily and Spain and Greece. And pretty soon, now you're not fighting these small kings in Greece and Macedonia, or putting down a rebellion in Sicily. Now you've got to deal with the other, as you said, big boss empire in the Mediterranean, because you've been sucked into this.
Right. I mean, it's at its root, if you look at the major wars in history, they start from two small nations in different spheres of influence, hashing out some old conflict which nobody outside the region knows about. I think about the Second World War as it was fought in Macedonia, and you know, the Yugo boomers will beat their chests about, you know, how we defeated fascism. But if you look at it, you know, it's a completely non-ideological conflict between rival tribes vying for territory, supremacy, and resources, with using the cover of the greater conflict, which did not initially involve them, to do so. And that's the history of human war, of human conflict. It's ultimately local every time, even between empires. And So I'm not inclined to believe the stories of the grand stratagems. And of course, Russia in its state really has nothing to gain from a bellicose stance. And if you look at, you know, the Russian behavior in the past 20 years, Russia is not the bellicose party, right? I mean, I'm disclaimer, I'm not a big fan of Russian behavior in Eastern Europe in the past, 100, 200 years. But in the past 20 years, they have not been bellicose. They have been mostly defending what they consider to be their sphere of influence. So that they are the initiators of this Lukashenko stunt with the migrants, I'm just not buying it. Of course, they will protect Lukashenko from outside interference, but it is what it is, I guess. But America's certainly looking, not just from the shenanigans in Ukraine and Belarus, but certainly the Afghanistan withdrawal is what really took the wind of America's sails. It's another Vietnam. It's a second Saigon. Oy vey, it's a second Saigon.
Yeah, I think what really sort of struck me about that episode was the fact that they were fixated on a date to get these people out. It had to be for political purposes to be before the September 11th anniversary. And it didn't matter what went to hell, you know, who got left there. You had to have this, quote, triumphant moment. I don't know what they were expecting to see, but certainly not this. And they knew that they couldn't get this done right if you had that date, but they did it anyway. And, you know, in such a way that, yeah, I do think that that was pretty terrible scene. And I'm kind of in America, so I can't really comment on how the rest of the world is seeing this. But we certainly saw it. And it was just a disaster, catastrophe. And I read your articles about, the pullout of Afghanistan and how this is, you know, like a move against the Zionist empire. And absolutely, I agree with that. But as an American, it was just like, oh, gosh, you know, this is terrible, right, in terms of our image. But it's just something that I'm not sure how they're going to recover from, at least for the foreseeable future. I don't see it. But how would you say? Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that I guess we can circle back to the question of who's doing the winning and who's doing the losing. Now, of course, most of the fighting for the empire is done by, you know, white American males specifically. And but the empire itself took an L, you know, took the loss over there. I don't really see it because there was no decisive defeat of the American troops in Afghanistan. It was just retreating after failing to secure the territory for 20 years and then just a takeover by the Taliban for... It was really like Hannibal blundering into Italy, you could say, or heroically entering Italy with his elephants, pushing everything around, beating everything half to death, but ultimately not managing to alienate Rome's allies from Rome. And yeah, and no matter how brave the men who fought under him were, no matter how brave he personally was, how brilliant, ultimately the question of war is when the dust settles, who's left standing? Who's left holding the prize? The prize being, of course, in the case of Afghanistan, the country itself. The Kabul regime just melted away before the Taliban. Just let's think about that victory and that defeat. The fighting men did their jobs. They did their jobs admirably, but the empire gave them an unfulfillable mission. So, of course, they were not able to fulfill it. That's I guess my opinion on it, to tie it back to the Kanai question.
Right. Hannibal was also using a lot of mercenaries. I think that
was the American Empire.
Right. But they were convinced that they were citizens, I think. Which is, I think, another reason why Rome was able to muster all of these people, because they thought they had a stake in this thing. Whereas if you're drawing your manpower from a vassal territory like Numidia, you know, or Libya, you're not going to have that same character. And that's, I think, what got Rome in trouble later on, is because they were staffing their legions with foreigners, basically. People who, that's what really kind of sealed their fate at Teutoburg, because they'd trained this German chieftain's son to be a Roman. And it didn't work out. It worked out in a lot of cases, but not in those cases. Rome had a few really bad days. And I think Arminius, the German, was one of them. And that's really what sealed Roman's fate. It's because they were not citizens who had a stake in Rome anymore. And I think in order for the American Empire to really lose, their soldiers are going to have to start feeling the same way, that they're just pawns. They're not citizens in this. They're just mercenaries, imperial mercenaries, who are given, as you said, an impossible task, set up to fail. But I agree with you there.
Well, I think that white men in America have finally gotten the memo. From what I can tell, many white men in America are taking my advice, and at the very least, they're not serving in Zog's Legion, in the American Empire's legions, as policemen or as soldiers, or Marines and seamen and Coast Guard people and Chair Force people. So I guess that's a positive development. And it's one of these, I've said many times in the past, the way the dissident right maybe does not win, but the way we force the enemy to lose is by starving them of personnel, by starving them of white men to be fed into the meat grinder of imperial institutions, not just the army, not just the police, not just the armed forces, but also the civilian institutions. I know one of these people said it, I want to see them run the government without white men. It's just not possible.
Yeah.
But it is one of those things. And of course, as America becomes browner, so will its institutions, the military, the government, the police. And I expect everyone to be wearing a mulatto perm. Now, Robert Hampton wrote Mulatto Perm America. And we don't often talk about, fashion on the distant right.
Yeah.
But we should. We definitely should, because fashion is a very big part of culture. It's one of those things that you wear it every day. I try not to wear clothes whenever possible, but apparently I have to, because otherwise I'm scaring the neighbor lady. And I style my hair in a particular way. I have this thing, I've had this thing for 2 years. It's called a chohol. It's inspired by Ukrainian Cossacks. But if I had it if I put in those, I've seen old ladies wear them, I can turn it into a mulatto perm. And apparently, it's the hottest new hairstyle for racially ambiguous mercenary Americans.
This is a term that I had not heard of, but he's right.
Well, are you aware of the phenomenon?
I was not before I read this article. And then I thought, okay, well, I'm going to have to pay attention next time I go outdoors. And with a certain segment of the young population, he's completely right. He's right. So many curly haired men out there, like dark curly hair. And yeah, it does make them look less white, or at least, I don't know. Almost, I would have associated that more here with maybe kind of being Jewish than the mulatto look. Usually I can tell But a lot of people, white people, who are now supporting that hairdo, to me, they look sort of Jewish now. But he's right. That is sort of a thing that I've been noticing.
It's maybe it's something about the way that the hair bunches itself up at the top of the head, which distorts, visually at least, the shape of the face and makes you look more like a mulatto than otherwise. But yes, curly hair is a stereotype of Jews, and for good reason, right? I mean, a lot of Jews have curly hair. It's also very common in Mediterraneans. A lot of Italians have curly hair, and in the Eastern Mediterranean, I mean, Arabs are Arabs again, with they have a lot of Arabs have curly hair, but I've seen curly haired people before. They don't look non-white. You know, not even the Jews I know who have curly hair, they don't look as aggressively. Really, it is a mulatto look. Like it, a lot of these kids, I walk around town and I look at these kids, and it's like they're trying to look like racially ambiguous chateau artistes called the mystery meatballs, right? Mm-hmm. You don't look black, you don't look Mexican, you don't even look Jewish, you look like all of those things and nothing in particular. And there was an article on Countercards, maybe it was 2 months ago. It was like how basically all non-whites on the planet in America get niggerized, right? If you're Arab, if you're Mexican, if you're Guatemalan, if you're Hmong from Vietnam, you're all just going to be niggers. You're all just going to be ghetto garbage. And all of these cultures, which are, you know, long and ancient and beautiful in their own ways, even if foreign, they're just going to be brought down to the level of swaggering ghetto sports shoe, whatchamacallit. And that's, and it's something about this hairstyle which just bugs me. And of course, it's completely unmanly. Let's not face it. If, like, I'm not against grooming yourself, grooming your hair, but putting those plastic things, I forget their name in English, into your hair, to me, it was always, because I grew up at a time where it was old ladies who did this to their hair, you know, it just looks unmanly, right? If you're a man, you should not do that. And
I guess
maybe
that's
it's the infantilization of young men. Like, I treat my Zoomer friends, you know, I like men because they are men. They are young men, but they are men. And I expect of them to act like men.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they must be perming their hair. This must be a perm that they're getting done at the hairdressers, you know. Yeah, like a woman would. And let's because men, they do love to preen too, in their way, I think. It's the military uniform. Yeah, there you go, your suit. And, you know, women really like that. This is not something that I think real women really like. Like men with curlers in their hair, I'm sorry. You know, it's just, it's really horrible. I don't think even that very regrettable Napoleonic look where you had kind of the braids hanging down. It was like the hussar look. Yeah, the braids on each side kind of hanging down. Yes.
I thought that was the Hasidic Jewish thing.
No, it was Napoleon's hussars were doing something like it. It wasn't that specific, quite that look, but it was something very much like it. If you've watched The Duelists, I think it was a movie made in the 70s and a very good movie, but it follows these two men who have this series of duels. They're both in Napoleon's army and they start out with that hairdo. They're both cavalrymen. And eventually it changes because fashion changes.
Oh, so they braid their hair.
Something like a braid, but it's not the way that maybe a woman would braid her hair. That sort of very tight, attractive kind of braid looking thing. It's something a little different. It's more of a battlefield braid type look. Mm. Yeah, it's, but it's called The Duelists. It's, I'm trying to think of
maybe,
the director.
Maybe it's a question of practicality because they wore their hair long back then, you know, men. And I'm thinking if I were, you know, sparring, I would braid or, you know, fix this thing somehow, because otherwise it would get in my eyes and it would be a liability. So maybe it's, but yeah, it fashion often arises out of practical considerations. That's the thing.
Oh, there was nothing practical about a lot of these Napoleonic uniforms. These were men who wanted to look colorful and frightening. And they took pride in how they looked on the battlefield. You couldn't call it feminine, because these are men who were riding into battle fearlessly. But they did take pride in how they styled their hair. You know, and it's that, I think, maybe I would contrast to what's going on now with the mulatto perm look. I mean, who are they doing this for? It's not to show any signs of masculinity or bravery, really. It's designed to make them look what? Like a mystery. It's not designed to maybe impart identity as this part of this very disciplined group of cavalrymen. They're just this, yeah, mystery meet, going to a concert in Astroworld, which is actually in Houston. And I've been to it. And again, this used to be a nice family environment, right? And it's not that way anymore. It got chimpy cheesed too, apparently. And I thought the place had closed, but I guess it is still having concerts. And people are still having a good time there, I guess, with their drugs and their stampedes.
Well, late stage empires cannot afford to, you know, shut down their Bacchic cults, because that's one of those things. I was thinking about this because a friend recently spoke to me about the question of pharmacological assistance with anxiety. And I'm thinking just how much of frustration with late empire problems is waylaid by drugs, alcohol, you know, legal and illegal drugs. There's just people pumping these benzodiazepines, these anxiolytics, these antidepressants into their bodies, which are, they're absolute poison. They distort the thought. How many kids are on psychiatric medicine? I guess, yeah, but it's maybe I'm turning into an old man, and it's those damn kids with their curly hair. But there is something just profoundly.
Well, you know, are they having a good time? Because again, I'm going to take this back to Rome, okay? There's this painting. It's called Romans and Their Decadence. And if you look at the painting, this is, it's a group of people who are at this orgy, basically. And it's late stage empire. And you look at it and you realize that over half the people look like they're having a terrible time at this party. You know, and this is, they're supposed to be having a great time. There's alcohol, there's women, there's, you know, all of this stuff going on. And no, it's completely miserable, completely miserable. And this is where we've gone from, okay, Scipio Africanus at the Battle of Zama to now this. And so, yeah, I watched this video. Obviously, they're not having a good time. It's mumble rapping. How can you have a good time at that? And also, people are getting trampled on.
What is mumble rapping?
See, this was another thing that I'd never heard of until this article. So I really have to thank Robert Hampton, I think, who read it. So mumble rapping, from what I gather, is Travis Scott, I guess, is the artist here. And he just kind of mumbles into the microphone in a way that you can't really tell what he's saying, what he's rapping. And it's this very low-key, tonal kind of music that basically lulls you into this kind of, I guess, drugged-out space where you think you're having a good time, but actually you're in the middle of Astroworld getting run over and taking drugs and watching this person who has no artistic talent at all. That's what I gather is mumble rapping. We've gone from, you can maybe actually detect some words in rap, to this is just very kind of low key. I don't know. It's, if you listen to Travis Scott, and I did, it's, you know, have you watched the video where he was,
I'm afraid to,
if you watch the video where they're kind of carrying the people out who have been trampled, he doesn't stop the concert, which was also what the article was talking about. Even as these people had died, he was still kind of mumble rapping through this. And it's the sound that he makes. It's almost like this bass kind of, that's it.
So he's droning and mumbling.
Kind of, yeah. It's right, and it kind of puts you in this
mumble rapper.
Exactly, right. Exactly. You got it.
Right. I might try my hand at that. I might have to come up with a whole new identity, but it's worth the old college try, I guess. I'm turning into my dad. I find it incredible that the kids would demean themselves in such a way, but they are doing it. They are walking around with, not heterosexual hair, let's call it. They're listening to inane crap. And what was amazing to me, I see in that crowd, yeah, they could be white. They could also be Mexican. There's some blacks. I mean, even if I were Mexican, why would I be listening to mumble rap, right? At least I remember from my time, the low-rent Mexican music was a reggaeton. And whatever you say about reggaeton, it was not music on meth. It was maybe music on speed or on cocaine, but it was not, it's one of these, I guess, music for low energy, post-ironic, late stage imperial people who aren't really having fun at the orgy. But let's not talk about that, because this is actually more depressing than I expected. Catherine, you're a woman, right? What do you like in a man, especially in the hairstyle, the beard style and dress style? And here I'm expecting a description of myself.
Okay. I'll talk about what I like in Matt, my fiance, who I met, some years ago. And when I first met Matt, we were both kind of going to this master's program. And I remember kind of sitting in the bar with the rest of my group. And one of the guys started talking about how he hated people who smoked in bars. And Matt, I don't know whether he was nervous or whatever, he completely blew up at this and was like, "What's wrong with smoking, in a bar? That's what you're supposed to do in a bar." So I thought this was pretty great. And he also kind of started to grow this huge Civil War Stonewall Jackson beard, which I'll be honest, I was not super excited about. Now he has a beard that it's probably like yours. It's a little darker. He's got Hungarian blood in him. So he looks
so
kind of Hungarian. So he's I think he's very handsome with his beard. And he's a guy who I think is, sensitive. He listens, but he also takes charge. And of course I like that. That's what I like about a guy. I'm not dating a guy with a mulatto perm. That's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. And because I'm from Texas, I also do like a guy who, can do things in the outdoors, can fix things. And, frankly, maybe wants to be off, maybe hunting. I don't have to go hunting. That can be the preserve of men, I think. Because right. I have no interest in actually shooting something unless I have no other choice. But my father was a hunter and he was a pilot. And I don't know, I like a guy with a sense of adventure and who's not afraid to, to talk about things in a real honest way. That's what I would say. As far as hair goes, I'm not too picky. As long I say as if you don't have like that Stonewall Jackson Afghanistan cave beard, I'm okay.
I used to have the Afghanistan Stonewall Jackson beard. It was part of a bet, but I was very proud of it, to be honest. But all of you young bucks in the chat listening to and people listening to the replay, notice she did not describe a man with regard to looks. She described a behavioral type. And this is normal. This is expected. Women, what they find attractive is certain male behaviors, right? I'm not saying don't dress up, don't groom, don't preen. Women don't like it when you stink or when you dress like a bum. But understand you'll be primarily dressing for other men in a completely heterosexual way. You know, it's to show that you are a respectable man to win a place for yourself in the male hierarchy. And this is something we should understand. And this is like basically you're dressing to impress other men. And you're also grooming your hair and beard to impress other men. And if I see you with a mulatto perm hairstyle, you're permanently banned from the ethno state and you will be removed from it by catapult. And that's the law. That's the law. It will not change. If you ever catch me being nice to people with mulatto perms, you are free to shoot me because I have gone insane or am betraying our folk. a little fed pulse just to keep those things spicy. Yeah. Anyways, we are live on the Writer's Block and we have donations on Entropy. And of course, you can donate. You can ask questions. Let's just quickly go through these questions and then, you know, talk about the last few articles. We have 20 American dollars from our heroic moderator, Gadius Maximus, who says, this question was meant for last week, but it will work fine this week. Bowden said communism had the effect of preserving in permafrost what it meant to be European for the countries it affected. Do you agree? And does Kat think global homo could do the same thing for the historical American nation? Well, Catherine?
Oh, geez. Okay, so the question is basically, communism froze a lot of these countries in time and sort of stopped their progress, I guess. Is that maybe the question?
Stop the degeneracy, you could say.
Stop the degeneracy, okay. Is Globo Homo going to stop the degeneracy? Certainly not. I mean, it's part of the global degeneracy. I actually think that the globalist playbook, it's another article was talking about that and how this kind of regime, these non-state actors, actually, Open society playbook, and yeah. And how these players are actually kind of fomenting decay using this agenda here. No, I don't think it's going to stop degeneracy at all. It's certainly not doing that here. It was really hard to read that article because you're talking about these people who have so much wealth and access to this power who are making these decisions. And it's like, wow, what kind of power do we have to counteract that, to counteract the decay? And does that mean that we have to decay so much into mulatto perm America? We have to destroy ourselves, yeah, in order to be born again into proud, straight and wavy haired America. I don't know.
Right. I will give you my answer, Gadius. I mean, I'm loath to disagree with Bowden without seeing the quote in context or hearing it, but there is a myth in the West that, you know, old school Marxist communism as practiced in the East was free of degeneracy. It was not. It promoted, maybe not trannies, maybe not tranny bathrooms, but it certainly promoted feminism, women's liberation. It promoted sexual profligacy and sexual incontinence in men and women. And it promoted, you know, disobedience of parents. Really was, it was a liberating, like we were talking last time you were here, Catherine, about George Fitzhugh, and you know, he calls it slavery, but we said that human beings thrive in a state of unfreedom, right? When they subordinate themselves to a greater will. And Eastern communism was a revolutionary movement which fetishized freedom, you know, above all else. sought to liberate people from their families, sought to free the peasant from the land, paradoxically, and, you know, ironically, stealing his land, nationalizing agricultural land, and then driving the peasants into the cities in, you know, with degrees of cruelty not seen since the encirclement movement in the United Kingdom in the early 19th century. But no, I'm going to disagree with the idea that basically European culture was preserved in permafrost by communism. I think communism wrought uncalculable damage to Eastern European cultures. And we are, if we look more healthy at this point, it is because we are trying to pick up the pieces, if we can even remember where they are, if we can even remember that we are people, you know, a people or peoples here in Eastern Europe, and rebuilt from communism in many places. You know, the old commie elite is still here, but now they're liberals, now they're Democrats, now they're progressives, or maybe they're children. And but, you know, in many cases, these decrepit octogenarians are still in power. And that's the tragic thing, Gadius. So I hope that answers your question. I don't think communism preserved anything. In fact, I think communism destroyed a lot more than we think. We have a message from Cozy James for $50 American, who said, "I used to live in Bayswater, a short walk from Kensington Palace. I thought my flat at £3,000 a month would afford me some respite from Negroes, but the whole area crawled with Pakis and Negroes." This is probably referring to London. I think Kensington Palace is in London. Well, that's, I guess, that's good to know, Cozy James, but I'm not sure why you felt the need to share that information with us. Kat, you have anything to comment on that, housing in London?
I guess I only have to go back on my European visit that I made in the early 2000s, and I did go to London. And even then, it really did seem like a very international city. I saw a lot of who I thought were Chinese people, people from East Asia at the time. I didn't see a whole lot of Asians and Pakistanis. Maybe that's because the area where I was in. And I stayed on Drury Lane, and there was this hotel there, and there was also a theater. And I remember walking to Covent Garden, which is an area in London where there's a lot of market stalls and sellers there. But it didn't seem like I saw a whole lot of South Asians or Black people. It seemed mostly East Asian, a lot of East Asian restaurants. I think we even ate there once. But even then, it seemed like it was going toward less English, less British people, and a much more cosmopolitan city on the order of, say, New York, something like that. As for the housing there, I've never tried to buy a flat in London. I know somebody who has and is apparently living next to Paul McCartney. But I don't think that person has to deal with a lot of Black people trying to disrespect them. I could be wrong, because right, there are probably more foreigners in London at this point. But I think that neighborhood is probably pretty safe.
Yes, and let's not forget that whatever their other faults, Black people do know music, so they'll know to stay away from Paul McCartney unless they actually he inflicts his inane wailings on them.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I've never been a Paul McCartney fan. Yeah.
It's one of those things, right? I would prefer listening to some forms of Black music, not mumble rap, obviously, right, to, you know, Paul McCartney. I'm probably going to lose my white card for that, for saying that. We have $10 American, a $10 donation from Malaparte, or Malapart. I guess Malaparte, we'll have to do Malaparte. Would it be untimely to ask Catherine to expound on Something in the Water, She depicts how dirty 19th century urban centers were. Implication is that vaccines not reason for decline in epidemic disease, but better sanitation. Yet Catherine seems to favor royalist authority over soft measures in Tuscany. Would you care to expound on that, Catherine? Of course, you wrote Something in the Water, which was about cholera. Was it 2 months ago or was it a month ago? I can't.
Oh, gosh. Remember. Sometime over the summer. So something like that. Yeah. I was talking about how basically both liberal and conservative solutions to the problems of the 19th century city and 19th century epidemics basically didn't work. And they didn't work for a long time. And I think vaccines and germ theory and epidemiology, I think they are very important to Western medicine, obviously. I think sanitation and trying to make these cities cleaner and more sustainable is just as, if not more important than medicine sometimes. And the problem was that they did not have great sewer systems, even as these cities were swelling, you know, kind of unsustainable swelling. All of these people moving into these cities from the countryside, because in England, at least, there was this movement, the enclosure movement, which had started centuries before and had finally culminated in all of these people moving from the land to work in London and to live in these slums. And even if they didn't live in slums, they were living in these houses that, well, where did the sewage go? It just kind of went underground and it stayed there. And it stayed there. I mean, just think about that. It's all of these centuries of waste there, and it's going to poison the groundwater. It's going to poison the Thames. And eventually, when you get a pathogen, like came out of India and transported via, you know, shipping vessels, and mostly shipping vessels for England anyway, and these soldiers kind of coming back from the east. And it just takes a little bit of that pathogen to really kind of create an epidemic of cholera. And for a very long time, of course, they didn't know how this was spread. They knew that it was happening in areas concentrated in polluted water, but they didn't know how to fix it. And you know, the state, it was really sort of its hands were tied. It didn't know what it was. And it also was very wary of forcing people to agree to these sanitation measures because it was hurting people's livelihoods. And the British government had said some years before, anybody who's a pauper or who dies in a workhouse, their bodies are going to be donated to science, and then they're going to be cut up and dissected so that we can study the human body. And this produced conspiracy theories that this cholera epidemic was really just a ruse so the medical facilities in Britain could get more bodies of poor people. And the same sorts of conspiracies happened in Tuscany and southern Italy. So this was not just something, oh, it happened in northern Europe.
Central Italy. You know. Right. Because if you say southern Italy, that changes the character of the people.
Okay, excuse
me. Big difference. So
central Italy and Tuscany. But it was happening all over Italy, too. And I chose Tuscany as a case study, just like I chose London as a case study there. And Tuscany at the time was ruled by a Grand Duke. And it was, you know, quote, authoritarian. But at this time, it was coming under sustained attack by a lot of liberal and nationalist movements. And so it, too, was very wary about instituting any sort of sanitary measures on the populace, even though it kind of knew that it had something to do with the hygiene of the water, of the people. And I guess my point was, is that epidemics are not just epidemiological or medical contagions. They become social contagions in the sense that they kind of peel apart what's at the heart, what's going on, what are the conflicts going on in society at that time, in the same way I think that COVID has now been doing. So it wasn't necessarily a comment on vaccines and how they've worked in the Western world. I think on the whole, vaccines have been very good in terms of life expectancy in the Western world. But medicine has not been without cost in the Western world too. I think I mentioned that. And my conclusion was that it's simply overpopulation, unsustainability and overpopulation in a lot of these cities, and especially in these areas in the East where these diseases are coming from, because that's where they always seem to start. And then they come here and we have to deal with them on a state and private level that sometimes explodes into these sorts of conspiracies and just social uprisings.
Right. It is, I mean, difficult for us to imagine. I don't think any of us have lived through a serious pandemic. Any of us.
Not like cholera.
Not anywhere near. I mean, all elders here in not even in Macedonia, like there was a variola, like a smallpox outbreak in Yugoslavia in the 1970s, but it only really spread to through Kosovo and Belgrade, but not even, was the capital of Yugoslavia, but not even the whole of Belgrade, but mostly the university hospital. Just the patient brought in from Kosovo because they really did not know what he had, right? Infected a bunch of the staff and other patients there. And the entire nation was, and, you know, elders here in Yugoslavia will say, well, you know, we had forced vaccinations back then for the variola, for the smallpox. But I say to them, smallpox is a disease with a 50% survival rate, right? Half of people who catch it will die. Mm-hmm. Cholera was something bigger than smallpox even. Very few people, I mean, relative to the population, as a percentage of population, because the outbreak was contained in the 70s. Very few people died in the Yugoslav outbreak. Nobody in Macedonia, which was at the time part of Yugoslavia, even though we border Kosovo. It's so nobody in living memory, I think, has any memory of anything quite like the cholera. Not even, I think, the Spanish flu was as bad. And I will say, these were real threats, and public health is a real field of governmental concern. Public sanitation, even more so. I was using basically the sorry state of the city of London in, I believe, the 17th or maybe the 16th century, back when, you know, they first hired street sweepers in the city of London. To demonstrate really the necessity of, government action to a bunch of libertarians. So like before that, you were just responsible for cleaning in front of your house. So people, what they did was they would scoop up, you know, the refuse, the manure, but from both humans and animals, the dead animals, everything really, the byproduct of the tanneries, and just dump it into the neighbor's yard in front of the neighbor's house, or dump it into the Thames River, and just toxify its waters. And we will have public health concerns in the ethnostate. If there is a smallpox outbreak, we will have mandatory vaccination in the ethnostate. My problem with the coronavirus vaccine, it's not, you know, the whole liberal thing, oh, my body, my choice. It's the fact that it is based on lies. Like I said, in the biblical sense, live not by lies. I will not live by lies. I will not have this lie injected into my body. I will not be bullied. I will not be cajoled. I will not be deceived. I will not be manipulated. That's what bothers me. But whether governments should take action to protect the health of citizens, yes. From real diseases, yeah. From fake diseases, no. I have a problem with the government lying to me. No. And I think we can, I think that's the question well and truly answered. Would you agree, Kat?
I do agree. I think that because of cholera, the state got stronger because it had to. Because this was a real threat. And the private water companies were not going to do a thing about it. They were not going to improve the water systems unless somebody forced them to do it. They were just going to keep lying, right? And say that, well, our water is fresh and it's from this area of the city and there's nothing wrong with it. When, of course, everybody knew that wasn't true. And they knew it wasn't true because they were bathing in this water. And this water was basically mud with leeches and tadpoles and all sorts of effluvia kind of percolating to the top of this thing. But, you know, I think it's crucial to be a little bit understanding here because they didn't have a sense of the germ theory. They didn't know that there were these microscopic pathogens like the ones that caused cholera in the water. They thought that if, well, you filled a water glass with water and you let it sit for, say, 5 minutes, all of the sediment, the bad sediment, would fall to the bottom and the rest of it would be bright water that was safe to drink. And, you know, clearly that's not the answer. And I think another kind of big lesson of that is science is a continual process. They say one thing right now that is going to be incorrect or at least incomplete 10, 15, 100 years from now. So while we should, you know, pay attention to scientific breakthroughs, we also need to keep in the back of our minds that this is not probably the final answer here because they don't know the whole story. And it could be that we're doing something incorrect, and probably it is incorrect. The scientific theory is more about failing than it is about finding the answer because it's a trial by error.
That's an excellent answer, Kit. So we have a donation and a question from ABC for $5. Thank you for that, kind sir. Is there a correlation between ancient centers of civilization and regions with periodically changing environmental conditions? Poor seasons, Nile flooding, monsoons, the need to predict the future for survival, enhance average IQ. I'm going to answer it this way, right? IQ is a parameter in the human animal, which pre-existed these living arrangements for humans. But what happened was, with the emergence of the context of the seasonal changes, the ability to predict them increased in survival value, which increased the premium on IQ in survival value. So it probably influenced it. Although I will say that the highest IQ people on the planet come from really the far north. So perhaps to a greater degree, living in a cold environment, improves IQ. Maybe it's not seasonality so much. Seasonality, however, does link to the European soul. I don't know how it relates to IQ, but I think we are the race which most acutely feels the changes of the seasons. And that's, I have my own softer poetic side, but it's one of those things I write very frequently about the changing of the seasons, especially winter, because I find it, you know, intriguing. Although my favorite season, you could say, is autumn, steely skied November, as always, harbinger of age, because my birthday is in November and I turned 30 and I'm an old man now with nothing but a dream of youth, you could say.
Oh, stop. Yeah.
Have you got any opinions, Catherine, worth sharing? Because I'm just going to embarrass myself if I keep talking.
Well, I would say that in the ancient world, I think this kind of regularity of maybe the monsoons or the Nile flooding, which of course is always connected to spirituality and superstition in these places. That's how they order the years and their lives and their religions. In antiquity, I think it was, more conducive during that period when you have rains and monsoons to form civilizations. And IQ, I think, during that period was probably linked to nutrition a lot of the time. And when you have a civilization like that, where you have crops and you have a food source that's stable, it's probably to your advantage. But I think that, you know, what happens in the North, and I'm not an expert on this IQ question, but I think the argument always goes is that because you have to plan for the future, you have to, weather these seasons of late autumn and winter, you form a kind of this future disposition, where you do have to be smarter about how you conserve your resources. Whereas in some of these places in the old civilizations, maybe they didn't have to do that. And it was kind of overtaken. But I think in general, I'm not quite sure why the Mediterranean areas kind of became eclipsed by the North, if they did. And how that has to do with, say, the seasons and cyclical change, apart from maybe the arguments that have already been made about you have to develop this kind of canniness, this inner knowledge of what you need to kill before the winter comes, and then how to store that meat and how to save food so that you have this going through the winter and into early spring. But I think civilizations who were dependent on the monsoons and the rains and the Nile floods, I think they had a much better advantage in the ancient period because they had a stable food source, which contributed to nutrition and certainly enhanced IQ during that period.
Right. That's one way of looking at it. Personally, I don't think the North ever surpassed the Mediterranean, but I would say that, wouldn't I? We have more donations. We have donations on DLive, and we do take donations on DLive, people. We thank you for that. 123 lemons in total from Silosopher. He's been donating since the beginning of the show. Thank you for that, sir. Peter Teft. Donating a diamond and saying, great show. Well, it should be. Peter Teft donating one Ninja Genie. Thank you for that, kind sir. This is over on DLive. Saying his grandparents are from Yugoslavia. He loves Tito. At least there, the people own the farms. Banks own them here. Peter, I would advise you to read one of my essays on countercurrents, which is Nations Not Projects, a response to Keith Woods. And last week we had Dr. Tomislav Sunic here on the writer's block, and we had some very nasty things to say about Yugoslavia. And among other things, the farms were not owned by the people. So I would advise you to read first the thing I wrote and then some of the articles by Dr. Tomislav Sunic linked in my article, and then you would be ready to begin learning about Yugoslavia, about communist Yugoslavia. It was not a nice place. People most definitely did not own the farms. In fact, that was one of the crueler things that the Yugoslav regime did, just nationalizing farms left and right and leaving them to be managed by the worst kinds of people, you know, managerial class commies. And Alyaska Chaga donating a Ninja Genie. And another Ninja Genie from Alyaska Chaga. We've had three separate plagues from China in the last 20 years alone. No one discusses this. This should be more often discussed. I mean, the Chinese are a filthy people. We have discussed this before on the writer's blog. I wouldn't call them plagues. right? SARS, it was dangerous. Bird flu, it was dangerous. COVID is not. And I mean, if unless you're 85 or something, which, you know, you're living on borrowed time anyway. I mean, I shouldn't be saying things. I have relatives which are 85 plus, but, you know, who are 85 plus? But it's one of those things, I guess. I mean, in the olden days, people did not cling on to life. That's whereas today, this, it's very undignified, this grasping for another 2 months, another month, another day. When my time comes, it comes. I'm not going to rush towards it, but I'm not going to run towards it, run away from it either. It's in God's hands. That's another thing I've noticed. Nobody really says it's in God's hands anymore. People really seem to believe this conceit that they genuinely control their own.
That reminds me of your article on Fortune, I think, that you wrote a couple of months ago, that people don't really talk about that anymore.
And of course, we have a bunch of people. We have Danish Warrior donating lemons, and Philosopher donating 3 lemons, 2 ice creams, and 1 diamond. He just does this in this number combination. I like it. My autism really appreciates it, but I don't know why. Maybe I can suss out the reason why. And I think we are coming close to the 2 hour mark. Now we can do some time over. One of the articles I've really wanted to discuss with you, and I think it's right in your wheelhouse here, Kat, it's Thomas Steuben's Trump as the Wounded Grail King. Now, I'm going to admit something. I am not familiar with the Grail King legend. So if you would not only just comment on the Steuben article, which I found beautiful, and, you know, but also give me a crash course in the Grail King legend. I mean, I know the rough outlines with King Arthur and Sir Percival and Lancelot sticking his lance where it does not belong, and of course Merlin and Morgan Le Fay. But I had not heard of the Grail King before.
Well, the Grail King, as far as I understand, is almost separate from the Arthurian legends. And the Arthurian legends actually kind of took this on or appropriated a lot of the Grail King legend. But the Grail King legend began as, it started off with, maybe you've heard of Joseph Arimathea, who is supposed to have caught the blood from Christ as he was being crucified in this cup. And it then became an heirloom that was passed on from Joseph of Arimathea's line, and that supposedly eventually ended up in Britain by kind of complicated means. But the people to whom it passed, the male lines, became known as Grail Knights or Grail Kings, and they were the keepers of this cup that still had the chalice, that still had the remnants of Christ's blood that, of course, could not decay. And the Arthurian myth comes in because I think it was, and I'm not sure of this, but it seems like it was kind of melded together into this kind of British English mythological tradition in which, during King Arthur's reign, they were not referred to as Grail Kings because King Arthur was the king. They were called Grail Knights. And it's not exactly clear to me, because a lot of this Arthurian stuff seems to contradict itself. But the Grail Cup was apparently lost. And so they had to have these knights who were pure or virtuous enough go and try to find this Grail Cup. And if you were not pure or virtuous enough, you were going to fail. And Steuben's article is interesting, not because he talks about really the Arthurian legend, but he focuses on this idea of the Grail King, who was not Arthur, but it's these seekers of truth, of the Grail Cup, of people who are going to be leaders who are worthy of passing down this very sacred relic. And he talks about mythology in an interesting way, because he says that it's these stories, these images, which are not perhaps true, but they're true in the sense that they speak to every age in the same sort of way that appeals to maybe our European souls here. And he talks about Trump being a wounded Grail King, as in he's no longer fit or virtuous enough to find and pass down this Grail Cup of Christ. And he lists why that is, because like any sort of myth or spell, you have to have certain steps. You have to follow certain rules, almost like a game. And you have to come to it with a pure heart. And you have to, I think he calls it asking the question. And asking the question is something that I'd not been too familiar with, but I gather that it's being able to find it within yourself to know what to ask and to be free of this kind of blame or shame in order to ask, what is the Grail Cup? What is it for? And can I bear it and then pass it down? And he's talking about Trump in terms of this mythology, this kind of complicated mythology. And he says that because he's a wounded Grail Knight, he's not worthy enough to do this. And we should abandon this figure and perhaps look to someone maybe from his own line, which I thought was interesting, in terms of our leadership. But I did get the sense that the dissident right is in need of some kind of sacred essence and a leader as well, and a knight, someone to look to uplift us in some sort of way, but that Trump is unfortunately no longer that person. And it's because of this very deep, profound knowledge that he gleaned from this legend of the Grail King.
So very interesting. I'm reminded, of course, of the tale of the Fisher King, right? Who was wounded and sick and dying. And so is his kingdom, reflecting his state. And I think that Thomas really is trying to convey this sensation that as Trump is dying, so is the realm. You know, he's lingering on, even though he should probably just go away at this point. And by this undignified lingering, which I commented on, I mean, we fear death so much in this world, whereas our elders, they didn't embrace it, but they weren't afraid of it, not as much as we are. They accepted that they were going to die at some point. And by lingering, really, he's hurting the realm. Certainly, I mean, I've spoken about really the, when you think about it, the distant right's primary enemy is the mainstream right, the center right, for the reason that they are the ones who are sucking out the oxygen, which is by right ours. They are occupying the space, which should be ours. We are, in the sense, this next generation of Grail Knights who should take up the quest, really, and we are the ones who have actually formulated the questions which ought to be asked, because that's the thing we were talking about. We are still diffusing their questions. Like, even the response to the coronavirus vaccine mandates, I'm happy that people are resisting, but this notion that the government has no right to decide public health, to solve public health problems is, I'm sorry, that's just going to kill us down the line. We should resist the lie, right? But still, but in this, people have been commenting on this, not just Trump, the entire boomer generation, they will just not go away. They and I'm not, this sounds, maybe sounds cruel and stupid, you know, maybe it's one of those problems with no solutions. One of the major reasons why housing is unaffordable, not just in America, but all around the West, is because for the first time, I think, in human history, we have a generation of people which regularly become octogenarian, right? Regularly live to be 80 in their mid and late 80s, right? And I think it's just distorting the housing market so much, creating so much housing demand. This is exacerbated by immigration. And not just that, people are saying that the political mood of the country, the political center of the country, the Overton window, and not just America, again, every country, just cannot shift because these old people are still around and they're with their old ideas. They're refusing to accept that times have changed. And of course, what are we supposed to do? Deny them medical treatment so they don't live to be 80? I think that there's like one extra generation running around, lifespans are so lengthened. But the alternative would be, you know, too gruesome to contemplate, I would say. So in this sense, this former person whose time is spent not retreating into retirement and letting the young generation take up the torch, it is a form of hubris, and it's also a form of the old Saturnian, you know, devouring your children, I guess.
Oh. Okay. I think that's on point. People are living for four generations now. That's never really been the case in the rest of human history. Your grandparents were ideally supposed to be around, you know, so they could impart their wisdom, but that was about it. It was three generations at once. And I think that recognizing the lie and recognizing the truth, or what questions to ask, is the key here. Because we say that, yes, that the government should absolutely take an interest in the safety of the people and the good of the people and what they can do to stop these epidemics, say, or these sicknesses. But how do we determine what is true coming from the mouths of these governments? And I think that is kind of the question that we're dealing with here, because we do want public safety to be an issue for our governments in a way that it really wasn't before, say, really the Enlightenment in any sort of specific way, because that's when you saw the development of this public safety being an issue for, quote, the state, the federal state, the national centralized state. But you also have this danger that I think Robert E. Lee mentioned when this military historian was writing to him. Lee said that, "I fear that," this was after the Civil War had ended and the Union had won, "that like all consolidated governments, America is going to become aggressive abroad and despotic at home." So that really is kind of the central conflict here. How do we establish a government that is going to be working for us, will not try to lie to us just to keep themselves, just to perpetuate itself, but to know that it comes from this organic nation? I think that's probably the biggest question here in terms of the Grail King, because he's not doing this for his own glory like Trump is, right? He's doing this for the glory of God, for the glory of his people, to keep this Grail cup within the line and sacred.
That's interesting, because the Z-Man who's been a guest on this show is fond of saying that the lifeblood of a republic is virtue, and the lifeblood, of course, of an aristocratic regime is honor, but the two are related, and you cannot have either of those two without belief in God. You yes. cannot also engineer it. People are looking for the perfect, system of government. I say a monarchy, a republic, a whatever it is, a vegetable growing co-op. If you have honorable men, running it, it's going to run well. And I'm going to throw my hands up and appeal to God to. And appeal to religion. We have lost our faith in the West. Let's not kid ourselves. It is tragic. We have lost also all notions of honor among men. We have lost virtue. We have lost all of these things. And for this reason, there's people out there like Donald Trump. And, I liked him in 2016, but it was obvious he was doing this for vainglory. And it's something to think about. It's something to think about. I think this may be a part of God's test for the distant right, that we were willing once to indulge another man's vainglory. Maybe in the future, we'll pay even a heavier price than what we already paid after the Trump election and all everything that happened after that. I'm not sure it was a mistake back then, but certainly his continued presence on the political scene is sucking the air out of the American dissident right. And that's not a good thing. He's really hogging the spotlight. How old is the man anyways? He's 76, I think. He's no spring chicken.
He's pushing Biden's age, I think.
It is one of those things, I guess. Well, Kat, we've been going for 2 hours and 15 minutes. I'm just going to double check Entropy, see if there are any more donations. And nope, no more donations. There's been no donations on. Oh, Flynn Photo just gave us an ice cream and 4 lemons. That's nice. I would like to see that conceptual whole completed, but I guess we are. out of time. So would you like to say anything to our audience before we sign off?
Well, I just want to thank you, Nick, and thank the audience for having me. I feel like we're ending on a kind of a down note here, but I think the Grail King myth is kind of something with, again, it's if I can kind of relate it to something else, it's like science. You're going to have more failures than you're going to have triumphs, but the triumphs do kind of make it worth it. And I do think that having Trump was probably worth it, because it did kind of give the people at least a vision of seeing something that, yes, maybe our country should be about us and our interests and what we want. And even though he is turned into a grifter, a wounded Grail King, he has not destroyed, I think, the image of what he should be, or at least what a leader should look like, what a healthy society should look like.
That's good to know. That's good to know. We tend to be Debbie Downers here on the Writer's Block, being, of course, the undercard show. We get to indulge in the black pill more often than the cool kids over on Countercurrents Radio. It's the founder effect. I have a naturally melancholic personality. I tend to see the worst in situations and the best in people, which is a very dangerous combination. But it is what it is. You go to war with the army you have, and you go live life with the temperament you have. And I guess this has been the Writer's Block, the best month yet on Countercurrents Radio. I'm your friend and host, Nicholas R. Gilvey. Tonight, our guest was Catherine S. She's a writer for Countercurrents. Catch her there at her archive link, which our heroic mods will post in the chat. And you can also find her on Gab, where she goes by Empress Maud. And I don't know. I know of a Queen Maud of Norway, but this is the first that I saw heard of an Empress Maud. And of course, I want to thank our heroic moderators, absolutely dominating the DLive and Odyssey chats. That would be Gadius Maximus and Bartleby. Gadius Maximus is on the record as saying that he loves life as he's shooting for 100. My friend, as a moderator for the Writer's Block, you shall live forever. And with that quite immodest statement, I bid you adieu. Bye-bye.